From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You know, we thought about Pixar as being the place for great animation, but it has been, I think, at least rivaled in the past 10 years or so by Walt Disney Pictures. Some of the great stuff of the past few years, including Wreck-It Ralph. One of my guests was the director of Wreck-It Ralph. I'm sitting across from Rich Moore. He's here with Byron Allen. They did the great film Zootopia. Guys, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Elvis.
Let me ask you to tell the audience, for the nine people who haven't seen it, because now even it's on planes now. It's on American Airlines for free. What?
Oh, no, they're not charging?
No.
We got to talk to American Airlines.
They're charging. They charge for luggage, so I think that pays for the animation. How would you know about this? The last time you checked your bag. Anyway, before we get into, you know, the socialism that makes National Public Radio so great, let me ask you guys to describe.
It's a new day.
Yes. Oh, my God. It is.
Yeah.
And the no better time for a movie like Zootopia, a movie about tolerance,
that's right, yeah.
than now.
So what a year, right?
It's been. I really good. I mean, first of all, a movie coming from a place like Walt Disney that's a political satire as much as it is animated comedy.
Right.
Was that first and foremost for you guys what you wanted to do? Because anybody's listening, you may know Rich's voice from many of the Simpsons commentaries.
Mm, yeah.
In fact, I knew you as soon as you spoke. I know that voice.
That horrible voice, that drone.
No. That's John Schwartzwelder.
Oh, that's true. Oh, man.
For those who haven't seen it yet, and they should, what's Zootopia about?
Well, Zootopia, you know, we started doing research into animals about 5 years back, and we quickly discovered that there are these two groups, predator and prey, that don't always see eye to eye. And as weirdly timely as the movie seems coming out this year, we came across it pretty naturally. We discovered that animals who don't get along sometimes need something in common. We went to Africa, and we were camping about 30 feet from a watering hole, and we would see lions come in and drink right next to gazelle and zebras that they normally eat. And everyone was kind of behaving. We thought, well, this is very similar to how human beings have to behave in our own society.
So the watering hole is Switzerland for these.
Yeah. Everyone is all cool here. It's all cool. Like, there are differences. And, you know, after nightfall, different stuff happens, you know. But it's, you know, one of the things we thought about is that what an interesting thing for an animated film to talk about. And we were very conscious, and we have to give really a huge amount of credit to our writers, Jared Bush and Phil Johnson, who worked with us for almost 4 years and 4.5 years on the script, doing iteration after iteration, because we knew if we're going to talk about a subject like this, we couldn't be cavalier about what we were talking about. We had to do a ton of research, and we had to really go as broad as we could with exploring bias from every sort of angle. And so I thought what they did, which is great, is they balanced a sense of humor, a sense of savvy and smartness. I think it's a good compliment for our audiences, too, that we try to, like, never talk down to our audiences. We always assume that our audience deserves the best possible film, and that's why we try to make these things so layered.
I think you did that, Barbara. Rich, let me ask you, because what I think is interesting about the movie is that it really, in framing terms, it's the history of evolution. It starts off with kind of a fairy tale about animals in the wild and ends in a city.
Right.
And I wonder if that was always, for you guys, part of the framing for this.
Yeah, the city was as much a character as people say a lot about their films. And it's the story of one rabbit's, you know, kind of drive to make the world a better place, you know. And we meet her, that she's describing what she thinks, you know, this city of Zootopia is. It's this place where dreams can come true, where people are treated equally. And upon, you know, growing up and following that dream, she goes to that big city, like you say, and discovers that it's messier, you know, than she thought as a kid, you know, that it's not perfect.
But it's also, to me, I just find it fascinating, that idea of using that opening and closing to sort of chart evolution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder when that occurred to you guys to do that, because that gives you quite the bookend for the movie, doesn't it?
Well, and we decided that, you know, because we all know, you know, that predators eat prey, you know, and it's like, well, how did this city come about? You know, so we wanted to kind of create this feeling of evolution, just like humans, you know. It's like we were horrible, you know, to each other in the old days. You know,
thank God things
really
are much better now.
Since then.
Yeah, it's all fixed now.
And but you know, we can live, you know, in a city together now. But then we go back to our bubbles. You know, we go to our echo chambers. You know, and what I like about the movie is it really explores that sense of if you can really harness fear. You know, if someone who has bad intentions, you know, of controlling the population can harness fear, you know, that they can really wrest control, you know, from its citizens and do a lot of damage.
It's interesting you bring this up, Rich, because I find myself thinking, and the movies too, is it's set that this city's utopia is a series of basically microclimates.
Yes.
The segregated areas in this way that kind of remind me in this way of Los Angeles, where you can live in one part of the place and never go to another part of the city. And was that part of your design too, to make it feel like Los Angeles?
Yeah, Los Angeles, I'd say, and largely New York. And we looked at cities all around the world because we wanted to make sure the city felt relatable to all audiences when they went. So we looked at Shanghai, we looked at Tokyo. We took.
Well, in terms of the size of it really feels like Hong Kong or Shanghai.
It's massive, right? Yeah. And then we took this amazing tour of the New York boroughs, you know, Bronx, Brooklyn, Chinatown, Little Italy. And it's amazing to see how the borders of those things change and how...
Across the street.
Right? And then we thought, well, this is... And I think that was Jared, one of our writers, who first proposed that idea, because we were trying to think of how are you going to organize... If we're going to make this really real, like animals really live there, they all need very different things. How do you organize that kind of thing? I think Jared pitched that, well, what if it was like New York? And we went and we did this amazing trip where we just took a lot of time to figure out like how these things evolved. We looked at how Paris evolved. Paris evolved in this sort of snail shell pattern from the center of
If you go outside the center of the city, it's still pretty segregated. In fact, Paris is actually a very segregated city.
Yeah, it's true. Like it's still very broken up. And one of the things that really worked with for us in a great way is it allowed different animals to kind of stay, like you said, in their sort of own environments, and then to have...
There's kind of a good and bad, you know, to it. The planners of the city, you know, felt like, well, let's give every animal, you know, kind of an environment that they feel comfortable in. But then it also kind of creates those kind of little microcosms that...
And we talked to the ADA about how if animals were different sizes or if humans were different sizes, we said, how would like a 2-inch tall human being get into this building? How would
The ADA you, of course, mean?
Oh, the American Disabilities Association. Yeah. So, and they're normally about how do you make these buildings accessible for the disabled?
For all people.
But lots of buildings, older buildings aren't.
And I think when you described it to him, like if we were going to build a building that had to accommodate people that are 5 feet tall, 6 feet tall, and then also like 5 inches tall, you know, what would that be like? And I think that they were probably wondering, like, what is Disney up to? Are they going to begin shrinking human beings?
Well, Disney's done that before. 30 years ago, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
See?
But we're going to make it real now, guys.
This is a terrifying thought that probably is about to happen. It's the treatment, by the way. My guests are the directors of Zootopia, Rich Moore and Byron Howard. So are you guys doing a lot of these things now? Are you on the road for this a little bit?
A few things. It's really starting up in earnest right now. And it's funny because Zootopia came out probably the earliest of any time that before award season. It came out right after the Oscars last year,
which I thought was interesting.
So it came out so early that we're doing a lot of just trying to remind people, like, we actually came out this year, you know, so remember us. We're part of this too, you know.
Well, let me ask you this, because again, for me, I just thought the movie felt like it has this kind of primal feeling that kids relate to, because there's so much, Judy's character especially, but even Nick, the other protagonist, they're so much smaller. And there's this identification that kids have with things that are smaller that I found completely fascinating. You guys were saying that this hadn't really come up before.
Well, no, I think you're one of the first people that I've heard kind of draw a parallel between a child's experience sort of physically in the world to Judy's. And we're very conscious about the animals that we chose for the film, because we did want Judy to be small and we kept those camera angles low so you feel it no matter how old you are. But you're right. Like a child watching this, I think, must have a much more visceral experience than an adult, because they're actually, you know, 3 feet taller, you know, and they're smaller, and they have to look up constantly to communicate with the people in the world, just like Judy does. So that's a very good point. If you don't empathize with your main characters, then you're nowhere.
And we're inclusive storytellers. You know, we're not making a movie for just like these guys and not these guys, for little kids but not adults, or adults but not little kids. It's like we want the audience to have an entry point into the story based on who they are or who they identify with, you know, and there needs to be someone to kind of represent kids. You know, there needs to be someone that adults can kind of relate to and see themselves in.
And one of the benefits of that layering, I think, is that people of all ages can enjoy the film. We had one experience in...
all species
here. In Brussels, there was a screening where we were watching the audience watch the sloth scene, and this Belgian dad was cracking up at the bureaucracy of the scene, and his little son, who was probably 3 or 4, like didn't get why that was funny, but he was just watching his dad love that in the movie. And it was such a nice experience for us to see sort of why we take the trouble to make these films appealing to people of all ages. And even kids, God, are so savvy now and very movie aware. I think they're very aware of storytelling. I think they're aware when they've seen something before.
Well, it's not about narrative all the time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, right? So it just feels like we owe it to them to deliver something that's layered and challenging and funny and emotional. And we try. We really try our best.
Well, and just even the genre of this film, it's a detective story.
Which is something kids don't really get.
Yeah, they don't really get. And our head of story said, like, you know, he kind of pointed out, like, this will be kind of, for a lot of kids, their introduction to this genre.
Yeah.
You know, it will be their kind of first detective story, you know.
But again, I just like that idea that certainly the movie works in big, broad strokes. But for me, it's the subtext, the idea that, you know, and I love having Idris Elba play his accent instead of, like, having him do something else.
That was funny because he was like, do you want me to be an American? I'm like, no.
No,
it's got to be you. It's got to be, you know. That's what you're known for.
And actually, that when he's not doing an American, it gives his voice size.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's this diminution that takes place when he's doing an American. You can feel a voice get smaller.
Then he's kind of trying to control it.
Exactly. Yeah. And the performances, I think Alan Tudyk, you can feel the wildness in the characterization. And I just wonder, when you guys were working with your actors, if you were trying to play on that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we invite the actors to kind of bring, like you say, with Idris Elba. It's just there's something about his normal speaking voice, you know, that's so commanding, so appealing, you know, and we want that. You know, there's already kind of a filter that's put up on the screen with animation, you know, that... we're not seeing the actor's face. We're not seeing their body language. So to try and put on something that's different from who they are just loses them a little bit more, I believe, into the background, you know. And I love when they kind of just let the essence of who they are. And that's how we cast.
Yeah.
That's how we like to cast, you know.
We really go out to
ask. The personality, you know, of those actors.
Yeah, that's true. Most actors will ask when they first come in, if they haven't done animation before, if they want them to put on a funny voice. And
did Jason Bateman ask you that?
Well, I think he had done a little bit of animation before, but we said, no, we really want you, especially Jason and Jennifer, Jennifer who plays Hops. And even like Octavia Spencer, for an example, like we needed Mrs. Otterton, who's lost her husband in the film. We needed someone who could get such deep emotion into that performance. And it's a tiny little scene, but she came in, and when she acts, she's sitting across from Rich and me, and she's getting tears in her eyes, and she's literally crying. And so you can feel yourself starting to cry when you're watching her perform. Like I'm so amazed by actors that can just bring this up and make you feel something in such
Well, just to watch her process and to see her get into that place and give a full performance.
Yeah.
It wasn't just standing at a music stand reading, you know, words off a page.
There's a reason why these people are so skilled at this. You know, it's such a unique talent.
Yeah, because I guess I just find myself thinking that there's a kind of a liberation in animation and listening to actors take their time and also in some ways playing to their strengths
compared
to being asked to do things that are a little different, and that's part of what acting is about, but getting a chance to do what they can do.
Well, even like you were saying about taking your time with scenes, I think we have the longest animated scene in history with the sloth scene. The sloth scene.
Oh, God. Yeah. That's really about taking. Well, I'm going to ask you to hold on to that if you mind. We're going to take a break. We're talking about taking your time in animation, The Woods of Zootopia, which I guess just won the New York Film Critics Award for Best Animated Feature.
Thank you, New York Film Critics.
Yeah, we're not New York. It's The Treatment. I'm here with the directors of Zootopia, Rich Moore and Byron Howard. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. You didn't want to hear what we were talking about during the break, but I'm here with the directors of the G-rated film, Zootopia, Rich Moore, and PG, forgive my imprecision, Rich Moore and Byron Howard. One of the things that we were getting at a little bit in the first half of the film is just sort of talking about the pauses and just having written, create these characters. Right. And I just found myself studying in all the characters. You mentioned the sloths before the break, Byron. The hairlines of all the animals and how well they're integrated into the actual animals.
Oh, yeah. That design. The groom? It's amazing to see. Like, we have the best craftsmen and women in the world who are working on these films. And we spend so much time talking about the story and the script, and they're magicians, honestly. And we are so blown away by it because they did research into the microscopic nature of fur, and every fur is different. Yeah. Got 64 different species of mammals, and there are literally thousands of these animals on screen at the same time. And we couldn't have done this even 5 years ago.
It used to be, 5 years ago, there would be something that looked like human hair kind of covering, the characters.
Yeah, exactly, or shag carpeting.
Right, yeah. Byron did a movie called Bolt about a dog.
A dog, starring John Travolta as a TV.
Yeah,
yes.
John Travolta as a dog. Yeah. And there was a scene, a pivotal scene, a big moment in the movie, where Bolt is riding in a car, he's feeling free for the first time in his life.
He's a real dog.
Puts his head outside the window, and it's like the wind's blowing in his fur. And they showed it to the tech anim guys, at the studio, and they said, "Yeah, we want to do this kind of cool effect on him to really feel what he's feeling." And they're like, "Oh, we can't do that." And they wrote a hack kind of.
Yeah, we had to hack it. We had to kind of create a kind of a cheaty algorithm that kind of wiggled the fur. It kind of made it look sort of like wind, but
wiggly fur.
And it just was not easy back then. And now. But now we have, there was this amazing.
And this was like 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah,
we're not talking about the 50s.
No, it was yesterday, really.
Yeah.
We're talking about that. But now that they actually wrote us real software where you can actually manipulate like hundreds of thousands of hairs, and it looks absolutely accurate. And I think that's why Lasseter is great about this. I mean,
John Lasseter, of course, who's the prince of animation. So, excuse me, my imprecision. The emperor of animation.
King. Emperor. Yeah.
He loves science and detail and research. And I think all of us now have kind of absorbed that as a mantra.
But what's fun to me about the movie, too, is that so often animated movies are about being yourself, and the best version of yourself is yourself. But this is a movie about not being yourself, in effect, fighting your nature, which is, I thought, was a funny idea.
Yeah. And being kind of a bigger version of yourself and coming to kind of, to terms with things about ourselves that we might not be really happy to discover about ourselves. And that's why I love that our main character is a police officer, and she's kind of uncovering the clues to this case, and kind of this icky center of kind of discrimination that's at the middle of it, and discovering that she too has that.
Byron, I guess I was bringing this up because, again, so much of this stuff is about, you have to be yourself. And this is actually about not succumbing to your nature.
Right, yeah.
But actually...
I get
evolving.
The question now.
Yeah.
Strike everything.
No, this is recorded, Rich. Sorry about that.
Oh,
but I just thought,
no!
But I thought that's actually a really subversive idea to put into an animated film. Because so much about be the best version of yourself. No, the best version of yourself, you got to actually ask yourself. You got to be aware of what you are.
I think so. Because I think that's why animals are so great. That's why I think animation can do a movie like this, like live action couldn't. Because these animals are symbols for all of us. And so no matter what your nationality, no matter like what race you are, what sexual orientation you are, you can look at this film and you can find some part of yourself, I think. And there's something about that was just so great for us to play with, because we played with it in fun ways with animal stereotypes. And even like we talked about Hops's parents, like bunnies are kind of thought of as being sort of somewhat fearful and kind of more at home in the country, and kind of like, more of kind of like rural folks who don't much go to the city. So Judy is really stepping outside of her accepted social norm to go into the city and become a cop. And so there is something about like challenging, really looking deep about who you are and also how other people are perceiving you, and not believing what people are feeding you as far as their
or letting others define you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was a really important theme, for us in this film.
We love that Judy has a flaw. It's like it's a lot, too often we
kind of got the mark of Cain almost.
Right.
She scarred at the very beginning of the movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And we think too often in animated films, like your main characters are too pure and too pristine. And so What I love about Judy is
so they'd just be a better version of themselves, which is already pretty pure in the first place.
Right? Yeah, but and what fun is that? I mean, there's no room to grow know, for your character.
But she's like us. She's a human being, and we all make mistakes. We make terrible, terrible mistakes, and the fact that you can step up and own that, and by doing that, you're not going to solve the world's problems, but the fact that you've made yourself one step more aware of how to deal with this, is, I think, is what the movie's about.
It's a tribute. One of my guests was just defined his rabbit character as a human being is Byron Howard. He directed with Rich Moore the film Zootopia. But I think what's interesting about that, too, is there's so many ideas going on in this movie. I mean, the idea that, for me, that this whole thing is set in motion for Judy by a character who is a small predator, but a predator nonetheless, and making us aware of what the scale of predators goes from small predators to apex predators.
That's true.
So that's, again, there's so many ideas in this movie, and you...
That Nick is a predator, but a small one, so he's afraid of the bigger one.
But also Mr. Otterton, who the guy really sets us in the motion.
That's true.
The case is probably the smallest, and you would think.
And most adorable, an otter.
That's true, right? But that was very intentional. Like, we talked about at length early on about, like, what should these animals be? We knew we wanted a predator and a prey, but there was some discussion. It was like, well, should the prey animal be, like, a big tiger or a bear? But there was something about keeping Nick closer to Judy's size, that he is a predator, like you said, but not an apex predator, not a predator who is still under threat from these other bigger animals like polar bears and tigers. Mm-hmm. And so there was something
about
the relatability.
They made them both kind of like underdogs, I think.
But also that sense of creating scale. I mean, I wondered... Mm-hmm. When that occurred to you guys, it can't just be like two or three different kinds of animals. It's got to be almost any number of phyla you could think of for this.
I mean, that's a great question, because in working on this movie, that was one of the things that really was like, oh my God, this is so cool that we're actually going to, try to do, like, a mouse is the size of a mouse and an elephant is in relationship to that mouse. And we found that in a lot of these cases with movies or shows or books, with anthropomorphic animals, that there will be this kind of scaling to kind of, make the mouse bigger, the elephant smaller, just so you can get them on the page together or compose them on the screen together. And there was a moment where we said, like, geez, because as we started to kind of block out shots, when we go into layout, which is basically kind of cinematography in animation, I mean, trying to get a tiny little bunny and an elephant in the same shot, it's challenging. But we said, no, this is unique to this movie, that we're pointing out differences, we're telling a story about, what makes, different animals unique and different human beings, unique. So we got to stick with that. No matter what the challenge is, we can kind of solve it, because it just visually, I think it made the story that much better.
Yeah, we have to think about all those. None of it's arbitrary. Everything is a choice. Even like to the species of like rabbit and fox, like we tried to pick animals where their stereotypes would be problems for them. Like for Judy, who wants to be seen as a big, strong cop, we picked this little fuzzy bunny who people think of, he's generally harmless and cute. And then for Nick, who, when he's a child, he wants to be seen as kind of a respectable person. He's seen as sneaky or a liar or cunning. And we tried to play with that because it was such a great part of the language of the film.
And in their characters, it's that we see Judy as a little kid. She has a run-in with a bully, who says, you can't be a cop,
Who's also a fox.
And he's also a fox. And that's where that kind of bias of, foxes comes from, that pops up later in the movie, that she takes that and she goes, well, I'm going to show you. I'm going to do it. Whereas Nick, as she discovers who's the fox, has a similar kind of experience as a kid. Mm-hmm. He decided, I'm just going to become my stereotype. I'm not going to try. I'm not going to try to grow beyond this. And they discover that commonality between them, where she, she kept going and he took an off ramp, and through knowing her is able to kind of reconnect, with that passion that he had.
I just found myself thinking about the thing you were talking about, Rich, the way animals are sort of defined. Like, there may be a small rabbit, but, in Warner Brothers, the rabbit and the duck are the same size.
Yeah, same size.
And the dog is the same size as the cat. And but in this movie, it's almost about the way people are literally viewed if they by being seen.
Right. Well, I mean, there's an idealistic kind of sentiment behind the city itself. The city kind of says, well, we can all live together. We can all get along. And no matter what size or species you are, you have a right to be here. Mm-hmm. And the movie pokes at like what that really means. Like, what is that easy to accomplish, or is it tough to accomplish?
Or is it impossible to accomplish?
And if it is impossible, how do you deal with that?
Right.
And like, what's the solution to a seemingly impossible problem? And so it was a really interesting, I think we learned about ourselves and about sociology. We worked with this great professor, Dr. Shakti Butler, who had this documentary that we watched called Cracking the Codes. And that really, have you seen that? It really opened our minds. And there are specific instances in that documentary that I think directly influenced some of the scenes mm-hmm. in the film. There's just so much, I think, that we didn't know about bias, or that I assumed that I knew. I thought that maybe a lot of this is behind us, but as we kind of dug through it and talked mm-hmm. about it amongst each other, it really became clear that it can be very subtle sometimes, and the subtle bias is some of the worst. And I think we're aware of the fact that Disney movies, we grew up on them, that they can have a profound effect on not just our generation, but future generations who view this. So we try to think about like what the film is saying. You know, hopefully we can put together something that doesn't feel like a message movie, but it like entertains you, makes you laugh, makes you cry. But
there's got to be a lot of work that goes into it, because as we talk about, there's a lot of layering of information and drama here.
Right.
But it feels like it's got to take 4 years just to so you can basically sort of say, no, we can't be, if you pardon the term and phrase, on the nose about this.
Exactly.
We've got to sort of make this so
exactly.
you move along with the movie and give it some thought and place for it.
Yeah, we want you to walk away with something that lasts, right?
Something that makes you think.
That makes you think and makes you
That's what I loved as a kid. Were the films that when I watched it in the moment, I'm loving it, I'm laughing, I'm crying, you know, I'm scared, mm-hmm. I'm thrilled. But then on the ride home, you know, or when you're going to bed, you know, in your private moments, I would think, you know, about it. Like, what would I have done in that situation? What are situations like that the character was in that I've been in? And how did I react at that time? I love those kinds of movies, you know, so we didn't want to make a message movie, you know. We didn't want to make a polemic or talk down to the audience and say like you should act like this, you know. But we wanted it to mean something. But we also wanted it's a piece of entertainment, you mm-hmm. know. We also our job is to entertain the audience too, you know.
Just the sense of hope, I think, is what we were after at the end of the film. Because I think we all get kind of discouraged mm-hmm. when we watch the news or when things don't go the way we want to in the world. But there is something about the fact that we can share our concerns with each other and we can help to buoy each other up in the face of these big problems. It becomes not a solution, but sort of a way of coping.
And we're out of time. I'm so sorry, guys. This went really fast. Thanks so much for doing
this. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Elvis. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. We're talking about the film Zootopia, the winner of the New York Film Critics Award for Best Animated Feature, and I'm sure many more accolades in its future. My guests are its directors, Rich Moore and Byron Howard. My recording engineer here at NPR West is Patrick Murray. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake Weiss, associate producer. I'm part of No Species. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.